I'm Michael Hawes, and you're listening to Train to Heaven. Chapter 13. Wolf. I stopped abruptly. I smelt spruce. I inhaled deeply and opened my eyes. I saw I now had the body of a wolf. I stretched my limbs and shook vigorously. I curled up my tail. A plethora of forest aromas intoxicated me. I dug into the soft earth. I relieved my bladder on a tree. I was on a forested slope of mixed conifers. Behind the thin trees, I saw bare rock. The stone ledges looked interesting. I ran up the mountain with joy. A rivulet gurgled on the left side, and I veered towards that sound. I drank cold water and continued. I reached a small waterfall and went to the top of it. I saw the valley below. The mountain behind me was crowned with snow. I heard the scream of an eagle. It flew high above the valley, as if held aloft by the power of my admiration. It circled and landed near a distant waterfall. I walked in a circle three times and sat down. It was a peaceful night. I began to sense a powerful female force. I knew the moon was coming. I looked between two mountains and was bathed in the yellow lunar glow. I sang my questions and slept under a ledge. I stayed in the mountains and hunted small animals. I envied the eagle and was obsessed with its ability to fly. I asked the trees for the secret of flight. They did not know. I thought the moon might know, and I asked her many times. She heard my songs, but answered only with her light. Once, I saw a little snake coiled on a seed cone. It had green diamonds on a black background. I was fascinated, and I learned to communicate with it. I told it of my obsession. The snake knew how to transform into an eagle. We must go to where the eagle had its nest on the cliff. We must close our eyes and we must leap. We must pray for the transformation and believe that it will be accomplished. We talked on our way to the cliff. The eagle's nest was empty. We walked to the edge of the cliff and leaped. I imagined I was an eagle. Fresh air streamed through my fur. I opened my eyes. The dark valley looked beautiful. I was the master of the moment. The valley floor ended my flight. The impact crushed my legs and cracked several of my ribs. My head ached and the thirsty earth absorbed my blood. I was immobile underneath a large hemlock tree. The little snake was uninjured and it slithered away before I slept. Chapter 14. The Wind. When I awoke, my body was doubled over a windowsill. I was limp as a wet sack. I was too weak to move, and I had a bitter taste in my mouth. I had vomited. I raised my head and saw another window. It was only a meter away. A family was eating their breakfast. I recognized them as my former neighbors. They looked directly at me, but not with disgust. My sense of pride made me attempt to leave the windowsill. The effort caused me to vomit yellow bile. Helpless in my shame, I watched the mother while she washed the dishes. A small gray kitten walked near my head, paused to chew on a flower, and then walked away. I closed my eyelids and I saw the silhouette of a man on a chessboard. The squares were red and black, but began to change colors rapidly. I experienced each new color as a taste. A warm wind began. The wind gradually intensified and the colors were absorbed by the darkness, like the embers of a dying fire. With the emotionless roar of a locomotive, the wind became a furious tempest. I was blown away by the maelstrom. I opened my eyes to the reality of my situation. I was in an abyss of wind with no reference point. Ascent or descent were unknowable abstractions. I was only conscious of motion. The only thing I saw was a thin silver cord near my face, which remained static. I grabbed the cord and it cut my hand. The storm pulled with mighty force. A sudden pain tore at my heart. Simultaneously, my movement abruptly ceased. I discovered that the cord was attached to my heart. I grasped the cord with both hands and I pulled to relieve the pressure. The wind swallowed everything except the righteous anger and tenacity. As my resolve increased, the tempest diminished in perfect counterpoint. Light returned, and I was standing near the window. The neighbor woman was now drying the dishes. Her complacency was unbearable. It was a cloudy day with brief interludes of sunshine. I decided to walk to the harbor. Clouds thickened on the flanks of the mountains while I walked. Cold rain began to fall. I was visited by a sadness that escaped categorization and remedy. My body was exhausted. My thoughts were turbulent, and my heart was swollen with questions. I heard something behind me. It was a small white dog which diligently followed me. I saw my mother walking near the harbor, and I shouted for joy. As I ran toward her, the rain became a downpour. She paused to adjust her umbrella and continued on her way. I followed and tried to think of an explanation for her behavior. I got under her umbrella and tried to speak to her. I saw that she was sobbing. She stopped and dug into her bag to find a cigarette. I stood directly in front of her. She ignored me and lit the cigarette. I gripped her shoulders and she shivered. I heard raucous laughter. It came from three drunk men. They were wrapped in filthy blankets and sitting against a wall. The dog growled and showed his teeth to them. "He wants his mother," said one man. The others snickered and cackled. My mother ignored the men. The dog seized the blanket of one man. The man cursed and threw a bottle. The agile animal dodged. Green glass shattered on the wet pavement. My mother finished her cigarette and walked away. I implored her to speak. I stood with the dog near the broken glass and we watched her depart. The drunk men coughed and spat. One man offered me a drink. "Your mother can't hear you." His voice was familiar. I studied his sardonic face. I stepped back. He was the shaman from the sugarcane field. He tilted his head to one side and put an innocent expression on. He drank from the bottle and smiled. I regarded him with fear and contempt. "Shit, man, tell him the truth," said one of the other men. The shaman laughed and looked at his companions. Then he turned toward me. "Look at me," he commanded. I looked into his stony eyes. "Kid, you're dead. You died in your friend's car, before the wedding." I knew that he spoke the truth. I saw that the three men were looking behind me. Their eyes were wide open. I turned around and I saw a young man. His hair was braided and tied with green yarn. He put a hand on my shoulder and said my name. He opened a pouch and sprinkled a circle of corn flour around us. "Texas corn magic," observed the shaman with sarcasm. "Do you think you can enter the circle?" the young man asked. The challenge was ignored. When I looked back, two of the men were walking away. A large raven flew overhead. I threw my clothes out of the circle. A pattern was cut on my skin with the fang of a rattlesnake. Thin rivers of blood made an animated tattoo. I was rubbed with crushed herbs. Then I sat with closed eyes. I smelled sweet smoke and I opened my eyes. I was in a small room. It had seven walls. The young man gave me a cigarette. I exhaled a cloud of smoke over the fire. "Smoke gives form to your breath. I'm Badger. I'm your relative. You have many different bloods. Your Cherokee blood is strong. You were born on our land, and we are your guides. We are the Wolf Clan. Your clan name is Kagali Unegiwaya. You know the three directions. Your birthplace was in the south, innocence. You went to the west, introspection. Then you went to the north, wisdom. You lack enlightenment. It is found in the east. You are not in balance. You're between life and death. You have no child, and you are the last of our lineage. Badger took me to Atagahi, a place where wounded animals go to be healed. Without spiritual vision, the broad expanse of purple water appears to be dry land. I learned herb lore and the hunt. I heard the ancient stories. I learned to combat spiritual parasites. They are known as raven mockers. Chapter 15. Avyakta. When I was ready to leave, I went to the east. Each day I practiced what I had learned. I found a beautiful mountain and I built a house on it. I planted a garden. I dried meat, fish, and herbs. When this was accomplished, I went to a river to wash. After my bath, I reclined on a fresh carpet of sphagnum. I intended to have an active dream. I listened to the river and meditated on the old stories I had learned. Several hours later, I saw my recumbent body in my own dream. The skin over my heart was swelling. My flesh opened and there emerged a green sprout. It took energy from the sun and from my desire. The mature stem made flowers. The roots grew deep into the earth below my body, like organic lightning. My flesh opened and I separated from the stem. My wounds disappeared and I watched the corn ripen. Inside one of the fruits, I saw a human arm. A tiny woman was inside. I put her on the earth. I held her hands, and she grew to my height. I named her Avyakta. Her hair was the color of a raven. Her eyelashes were the color of corn silk, and her eyes were hazel green. Her teeth were like tiny clouds. Her face was the color of the sky. Her left arm was the color of cocoa, and her right arm was like red clay. Her hands were strong and graceful. Her wrists were thick. Her legs and feet were the color of sand. Her thighs were sturdy. The color of charcoal covered her buttocks and extended up to her neck and right ear. Her left ear and breast were the color of teak. This coloration extended over her belly. She did not have a navel. Avyakta harvested the corn. I watched her with pleasure. She sang and her voice was honey to my ears. We brought the corn to our house. Avyakta rearranged everything in the house. She made clothing from the pelts I had collected. We slept beside the fireplace. When the first full moon appeared, Avyakta slept under a pine tree. We did not speak. I woke one morning to the sound of Avyakta singing. I walked to the river. Avyakta was washing in the cool water. I smiled and I went into the water. Avyakta sang and scrubbed my body with fine sand. My rattlesnake scars glowed. She ran to the shore and I chased the sound of her laughter. Avyakta entered a canyon. I found her on a rock in the river. She collapsed with laughter but armed herself with a stick. I advanced slowly because I saw fear in her eyes. I raised my arms and she raised her stick. I caught her wrist tightly and looked into her eyes. She dropped the stick. I released her arm and I broke the stick. I threw one piece into the river. I gave the other piece to her, and she also threw it. We watched until the two pieces had disappeared. I led Avyakta to a grove on the shore. She stood like a statue. I combed her hair with my fingers and I rubbed her shoulders. Dappled sunlight penetrated the foliage above. Disks of light danced randomly on her multicolored skin. I kissed her and tasted her sweet mouth. We joined our bodies and mingled our voices. Afterwards, Avyakta craved fish and fruit. Her skin developed a beautiful glow. I ate venison, peppers, and corn. I told her everything I knew. I was her father, mother, husband, brother, and lover. Her questions taught me much that I did not know. Her instincts were pure and undiluted. Her common sense was impeccable, and she was a complete woman. Her pleasure was to make us comfortable, and I was fulfilled as a provider. We shared our time and our chores. We never parted company except to hunt. We collected food and fuel. She taught me to make bird snares, and she was an accomplished fisher. We made deerskin shirts. Avyakta decorated them. Gradually, her belly swelled and I rubbed it with herbs. Her breasts eventually resembled teak melons. Her water broke one afternoon while she was picking mushrooms. The boy had thick black hair. The left side of his face was blue like his mother. The rest of his skin was brown-red. We named him Bjorn. I shared pleasant hours with Bjorn. Avyakta was a devoted mother. Bjorn and I invented a game. I would shake the seeds off a dandelion. Bjorn would catch them with a pine twig smeared with resin. The difficulty varied with the angle of the sun and the intensity of the wind. My son had the reflexes of a cat. We had neighbors to the north, a group of 8 people who lived in a limestone cave. There were 5 women and 3 men, and they were very old. They had become refugees and died during a terrible winter in 1838. They were our only friends. Bjorn often walked to the cave to visit them. One cold morning, Bjorn decided to visit his friends. At twilight, one of the old men came to our house. His haste indicated a problem. He told us that Bjorn had not arrived at the cave. "Please wait inside the house. Awiakta has made soup. I'll search for Bjorn." It was autumn, and I guessed that Bjorn would choose his usual route. Foliage, the color of fire, swirled around my ankles as I walked. My will was focused on the location of my son. I exhaled clouds of frost in the brisk wind. I saw a small mound of twigs 2 kilometers from home under Bjorn's favorite tree. I found him underneath it. He was pale and feverish. I carried him home. His hair smelt the same as his mother's hair. It was dark when we arrived. Awiakta was waiting near the door, and she carried Bjorn to the hearth. His complexion had faded, and he was delirious. Awiakta bathed him. I moved his bed near the hearth. He was not able to eat or drink. The next morning, our old friend returned from the cave. He said that the others would come to sit with Bjorn. The 3 old women arrived later in the afternoon. Bjorn awoke and drank some soup. His fever diminished, and he slept. The old women stayed near his bed because he had frequent nightmares. Bjorn remained ill. The old women sat by his bed. I eventually saw a common theme in Bjorn's nightmares, and I discovered the cause of his lingering illness. I used Badger's teaching to save my son. I found a certain kind of tree, and I cut 4 twigs. I carved them into points. I purified them with smoke, and I sang a prayer 4 times. I told the old woman to go back to the cave and send all the men to my house. After dusk, I pushed the twigs into the earth near the path to the house. The next day at noon, I heard a horrible scream, and I ran to look. I saw 2 old men standing near a 3rd old man who had collapsed. Awiakta came out from the house. The stricken old man had a hole in his forehead. His skin shriveled like a rotten peach. His body became a pile of dust. One old man spoke. "I was the 2nd person to die in the cave. Now I know this man stole our days. He continued the evil practice after he died. Bjorn has many days." I explained to Awiakta. The raven mockers attack people during an illness. They enter a person's dreams and they quicken death. By curtailing the life of their victims, they increase their own. This man was not the shaman I had previously encountered, but he practiced similar magic. I was happy that Bjorn would recover, but a danger still existed. Chapter 16. Coffee House. During Bjorn's recovery, the horizon became unstable. The trees behind the house fluttered like reflected images on a windswept pond. The disturbance had a definite boundary, which coincided with my mood. The boundary was near when I was troubled, and far when I was happy. When the weather got hot, I was troubled. Awiakta knew of my discomfort. She suggested I go for a long walk, north over the mountains. I wanted to take the journey. When I reached the edge of the forest, the trees were undulating as if they were painted on silk. I turned to look back at my family. They were working in the garden, and neither of them looked at me. I entered the forest. The trees fluttered around me. I penetrated the forest, and the disturbance became more intense. Soon, the trees were visible only on the crests of each undulation. All else was gray in color. It was difficult to walk on a fluctuating landscape. I had to infer, from the context of an incomplete terrain, where to step. Unexpectedly, I bashed my forehead on a solid object. It was a street sign in the midst of the forest. During countless walks in this forest, I had never seen any such thing. I rubbed my forehead and continued. After a few steps, I saw a traffic signal among the pines. The light changed from yellow to red. Then I made a further discovery. Undulations emanating from my house created the forest. Others, which created the city, came from the direction of my journey. I saw a piece of sidewalk and a trash container. A faceless torso paused to dig for bottles. I stepped on the sidewalk and looked back. From this perspective, I saw a big city street. There were a few trees here and there. I heard the sound of traffic. I walked along the street until all vestiges of the forest were gone. I stopped before another traffic signal. A street sign indicated that I was walking on Broadway. I crossed the street. A man with bright green hair asked me to give him money. My eyes were stung by the fumes of the vehicles. I smelt a miasma of fried foods. I needed a cup of coffee to remedy a headache induced by monoxide. I saw a group of people who were advertising different religions. They pushed pamphlets into the hands of the reluctant pedestrians. A prostitute who was dressed in chamois boots and a pink silk blouse walked among them. One of the pamphleteers watched her. "You can't push a horse with a piece of rope," said a bystander. I saw a neon sign, Ouroboros Coffee House. I went inside and found a table. A slender Chinese woman put a cup of coffee in front of me. My headache began to dissipate. On my left, I saw a man who was writing in a small notebook. He placed a cigarette on his thick lower lip and anchored with his upper lip. He stroked his neatly trimmed beard and adjusted his eyeglasses. Then he looked at me. "The style of your clothes seems to be southeastern. The decorations are Sioux. Are you lost?" "My clothes are Cherokee style. You guessed the decorations correctly. I love the patterns of the prairie." "A very interesting combination. I'm called Alan. I'm pleased to meet you." "Likewise. My name is Waya. Alan, is this city your own fabrication?"
"Yes, it is."
"I have a house nearby in the forest." The jukebox played an intriguing African melody.
"I have seen your house. In fact, one morning, I chased an angry raccoon out of the kitchen and followed it to your lovely house. Your wife is certainly interesting."
"I think I understand something of this phenomenon. Our individual realities emanate in undulations. Their intensity varies with our emotional condition. Their effects are polarized."
"By the 24 testicles of the apostles, the same old conundrum. I have written 12 pages explaining all this, utilizing the theory of particles. As you know, undulations have no mass. I evicted a real raccoon from my kitchen 2 days ago. If you're interested, I have another theory. An analogy, actually. I can say with certainty you're partly Welsh."
"My father's mother was born in Cardiff."
"Of course. Think of a gigantic oak tree. Each acorn is not aware of every other acorn. They fall to earth and they're scattered by animals. Each one is a potential oak tree. Many creatures take refuge in the physical manifestation of each potential tree."
"Do you suggest that we're from the same tree?"
"I do, certainly. It's obvious."
"I'm hungry. What food do you have?"
"Couscous, tea, and some fruit."
I noticed a change of ambience and I looked at the window. The street was full of people in Arab garb. The sound of traffic was replaced by the bleating of goats and the occasional roar of a camel. Alan put his hand on my shoulder.
"We shall eat in my private room."
He led me to a red curtain. There was a hammered brass table surrounded by cushions in the center of the room. The walls were decorated with tapestries, scimitars, and poems written in beautiful Arabic. We got comfortable. A young man brought tea. He poured the liquid from the teapot to the cups repeatedly until a light foam appeared on top. Our food arrived. We ate the spiced chicken with our fingers. Three musicians came into the room and began playing a lively melody. Our table was cleared. Small dishes of dates, candy, and melons were brought. A radiant woman entered the room and began to dance. I gazed on her and licked the melon juice off my fingers. Her hands told many stories. In the movement of her navel, I saw the rhythm of life. Her buttocks were like planets in orbit around the sun. Her breasts were cornucopias. Her eyes were lakes of compassion. Her dance evoked fire and gravity. I heard Alan's voice. "You might stay if you want. However, there's a train station across the street. From there, you can go to meet eternity. I have decided to remain." I knew that I must go. Chapter 17. The Train Station. I stood up and told Alan what I had decided. I went to the door. It was dark and the street was wet with rain. The landscape had changed again. Now the city looked European. I paused to ignite a cigarette. Alan stood beside me. He indicated with his chin the train station across the road. "Good luck, mate." "Thank you. Maybe we'll see each other again." "I would enjoy that." I pushed open the door and went across the street. I threw my cigarette away and walked inside the station. The roof was very high and it covered a vast network of rails. I saw a man with a yellow hat dancing with a woman with a lovely red bonnet. They were oblivious to the throngs. A large black man gave me a brochure on the topic of Islam. I watched the dancers and studied the brochure. I walked toward a huge destination sign which clattered frequently as it was updated. The crowd muttered. Arrivals and departures were announced in every language. Evidently, there were different trains for each religion. I was to choose one of them. I studied the sacred text of the Muslims, the Hindus, the Jews, the Christians, and many, many others. The first four were not difficult to assimilate, but the multiple schisms added to thousands of indigenous belief systems was overwhelming. I strolled inside the train station and questioned people. "How exactly is Jainism different from Hinduism? How is the Hopi creation myth different from that of the Cherokee? Do the Zoroastrians believe in a final judgment? Where does the Atheist Express go? Is there an agnostic shuttle? What was Nietzsche's decision? Was Goethe with him? Did you see Giordano Bruno?" Trains came and departed. People asked me to accompany them. It was difficult to watch them go. I sat and contemplated. My choice was a very serious matter. If multiple truths coexisted, my choice was merely a detour, a farce. Yet, there were consequences. I sat and smoked cigarettes. My indecision caused me anxiety. I tried to clear my thoughts, but I was angry. Most people had worried expressions on their faces. I saw some people who were waiting for the Buddhist train. They looked serene, so I waited with them. I walked away before the train came. I went faster and faster. I was running when I reached the door. I saw the Ouroboros Cafe across the street. Alan was writing in his notebook and drinking coffee. I saw a taxi and I decided to flee. I watched the road carefully. Although the driver was going straight, the train station repeatedly appeared on our right. "Go beyond the train station," I yelled. I wanted to return to Bjorn and Awiakta. The driver mumbled. I saw the train station again. The rain poured down. I tried to control my breathing.
"Bloody hell!" shouted the driver.
I saw a tall pine tree in our path, and then I heard a symphony of broken glass. I lost consciousness, and when I awoke, I was with Bjorn. It was a bright, sunny day. A fresh wind danced in the foliage of a horse chestnut tree, with roots anchored in a vast cemetery. A raven flew down silently and landed on a low branch. Directly below, there was the body of a dead raven. Bjorn paused near the dead bird. He sought counsel on the nature of death. I hesitated to answer. I was surprised by his questions. I saw the raven above and I asked Bjorn to look at both birds. Then I asked him to observe all the differences. Bjorn enumerated all the differences he saw. I told him death was a mystery with many different explanations. I encouraged his curiosity. I said that people believe many different explanations. I told him several versions. If I made a pretense of possessing the definite answer, Bjorn would explore no further. We began to walk and play football with a fallen chestnut. The raven made a loud croak.